Morning. It's good to see everybody out this morning. I have an announcement to add to Lex's. Miracle and Maya are here today, and Miracle brought home a boy with her. She brought her husband, Shane. I might say your last name wrong. Shane Mahan and Miracle have made it here. Shane's in the Air Force, and he's going to be stationed in Little Rock going forward for a few years, but we're certainly glad to have them here. And I think Becky's planning on a shower or reception at a future date. But we're certainly glad to have them and congratulate them on their nuptials, I think, right? So it's good to see everybody out. It's good to have everybody here on the holiday. There's a story that I've told before by a guy named Billy Sunday, and I always like when I read stories by Billy Sunday. What a name to have if you're going to be an evangelist, right? That's a pretty good, and that's his shoot name, I guess. You know, that's not like his gimmick name. His real name was Billy Sunday, and I think that's a good name. An evangelist from years back, and he tells a story, and like I said, I've told it before, of this young man who was converted to Christianity, and he was pretty hot about it and on fire, but he had gotten a job at a lumber camp that had a reputation for being a pretty harsh place to work. It was a very ungodly labor camp, and maybe you know, it was just a tough place to be. And so a friend of his heard that the boy had got a job at that labor camp, and he told him, you've got to really be careful. Those people, they're not Christians, and they don't like Christians. You've got to watch yourself. And the kid's like, I know, but I need money, I need the work. And so he goes and he takes the job. A year later, he goes back home, and he runs into that guy that told him not to take that job. And the man asked him, how's it going? And the kid said, you know, it's really not that bad. They've treated me really well. They haven't done a single thing to me. I don't even think that they know that I'm a Christian yet. Well, you know, that's some whistling through the graveyard. We probably all have done that some since. It'd probably be a lot more funnier if it didn't hit so close to home so many times. For some of us, maybe a lot of us, that's a harsh reality, is that sometimes the people around us don't even know that we're Christians, don't even know who we really are, or maybe they do know exactly who we really are, and sometimes we're the ones fooling ourselves. I think one of the things that this country lacks the most is moral courage to do the right thing no matter the cost, no matter what the consequences are, no matter the situation, this moral courage, even if you were to have to stand alone. And we just don't have that much or see that much in a place where we need so much of in this day and age. Some people have dubbed what we're living in as being a post-Christian era, that we're no longer living under those Christian values that the people before us had. Now our value system is sort of up for grabs, where we're all about political correctness or moral relativism, and we're navigating these strange waters that might seem unfamiliar to some of us, or maybe all too familiar with those people who have kept their finger on the pulse of society. Robert Kennedy once said that few men are willing to brave the disapproval of their fellows. The censure of colleagues, the wrath of their society, moral courage is a rarer commodity than bravery in battle or great intelligence. Yet it is the one essential, vital quality of those who seek to change the world. And I think Bobby Kennedy was right about that. That moral courage is the one essential, vital quality for those who want to change the world. Because really, we all have those opportunities to change the world, or at least our part of the world. We may not think about that in that moment, but every one of us is given opportunities to change at least part of the world. And if nothing else, we sort of need to question that we need to ask ourselves, is, are we brave enough to actually take that opportunity? Because more often than not, we don't, right? We're not. There is one other person here that in this story of Jesus at the cross that we're going to talk about this morning. And it's sort of the last one, because he's the last person to at least meet the body of Jesus at the cross. Of course, met Jesus before the cross as well. I think that the story of Joseph of Arimathea has great implications for us. Dallas read Matthew's account. Luke, in Luke 23, verse 50, he begins by saying that there was a man named Joseph from the Jewish town of Arimathea. He was a member of the council, a good and righteous man who had not consented to their decision and action, and he was looking for the kingdom of God. This man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. Then he took it down and wrapped it in a linen shroud and laid him in a tomb cut in stone where no one else had ever been laid. It was the day of preparation, and the Sabbath was beginning. All four of the gospel accounts are going to tell us the story of Joseph of Arimathea. And then that's kind of a significant thing in this series, right? We know this guy's name. We haven't always known the name of the people we've been talking about. We knew Simon, and now we know Joseph. Most everyone else has been nameless. But the gospels all tell us about this man who claimed the body of Jesus and buried it. And one of the first things that we're told here in Luke is that Joseph was a good and righteous man. And I'm going to say this wrong, but in Scripture, when you read in Hebrew there, the Old Testament, when you read that someone is good, or God says that when he creates something, it is good, that word is tov, T-O-V, and it's really high praise. It may be the highest praise, really, that there is. And again, that's the kind of language that God used when he created the earth, that it was good. It's the kind of language that's being used to describe Joseph of Arimathea. He is a good man. He is a good man, but even more than that, he's also righteous. Well, where good might be about sort of his approach to himself, sort of internally, but maybe his relationship with God, righteousness is how he deals with other people. He's a good man dealing with other people. He's good and he's righteous. So already reading this, we like this guy. We're supposed to like this guy, sort of cheer him on as Joseph of Arimathea shows up in his white hat. He's good and righteous. He's also an interesting character, but because he's part of the Sanhedrin, he's part of the Jewish ruling council, sort of like the Supreme Court for the Jews. This is the people that make up and even implement many of the laws that the people had to follow. The Sanhedrin is in charge of so many aspects of life, both socially and religiously. This is part of the court that he's part of, and it's a pretty high position. But even though Joseph is part of that group where he says he didn't consent to their decision. And so that's another thing that we learned, that he's part of the Sanhedrin, but that he didn't agree when they brought this trial and the mock charges against Jesus. He didn't agree whenever the Sanhedrin convinced the crowd to start crying out, "Crucify him, crucify him." He didn't agree when the Sanhedrin was asking Pilate to send this man to his death. That's what we understand. Well, whenever Scripture says that he didn't consent with the Sanhedrin, that may have been that they just overruled his vote. Maybe they didn't even ask his opinion because they knew where he stood on this issue. We don't know anything except that he disagreed. He disagreed with their decision, and that he's a good and righteous man. But make no mistake about it, Joseph has his faults. John tells us in John 19, beginning in verse 38, that after these things, after the crucifixion of Jesus, Joseph of Arimathea, who was a disciple of Jesus, but secretly for fear of the Jews, asked Pilate that he might take away the body of Jesus, and Pilate gave him permission, so he came and took his body away. So he was a good and righteous But he was also a secret disciple, and Scripture says it was because of fear that kept him in secret until now. And I wonder how many of us can relate to Joseph of Arimathea. How many of us are in fear of going public with our faith? You can be a secret disciple in one arena or another. And so we're here this morning, right? We are participating in church activities, and that's good. But what does it look like for the rest of us, for the rest of the week when we leave here? Do people even know that I go to church? Do people know that you go to church? Do people know that we follow Christ? I think at times a lot of us are like Joseph of Arimathea, who was in a position that made him feel fearful at times to stand up for Christ. I like the story of Nikita Khrushchev. Not long after he became the premier of the Soviet Union, he denounced many of the policies and the atrocities that Joseph Stalin had done. And that's a good thing, right? Nikita Khrushchev was right about that. But he did all these things, and then Khrushchev was interrupted by a man heckling him from the crowd. And the heckler said, You were one of Stalin's colleagues. Why didn't you stop him immediately? And Khrushchev roared back. He said, "Who said that?" And there was agonizing silence over the crowd. Nobody moved a muscle. Nobody wanted to admit that they had just crossed the premier. And so Khrushchev very quietly replied, Now you know why I was silent. Fear. Fear is a powerful motivator, isn't it? When we let fear in and dictate our faith, sometimes it doesn't work, but other times our faith comes alive in those situations. But for a lot of times, for myself, it's fear that wins out. Fear, whatever that situation may be, is going to take precedent over everything else that you know. They could know better, right? They know that they should stand up. They know that they should. You get in these situations and proclaim, and it's maybe not even a proclamation. It's just that I don't need to go along with this crowd. Or maybe I need to push back against this because this is wrong. This is sinful. That's demeaning towards a certain group or another, whether it's race or whatever it is. They know they're supposed to stand up, but they're afraid. And here's the thing. I know that's probably true about you, and that's for sure true about me. That there are certain situations where fear just takes grip. And again, if you're anything like I am, take a little bit of courage in this and a little bit of hope from this story about the secret disciple who, when the opportunity came, was no longer bound by his fear. When the opportunity came, he didn't let that fear that once held him back dictate his course of action anymore. And if you're in that kind of situation where you've let fear sort of take the driving wheel of your life in so many ways according to your faith, take a little bit of hope with Joseph. I'd say even if you feel like you've turned your back on Jesus, but because Jesus hasn't turned your back on you, he's giving you opportunities to step out in faith, to make your faith known, to understand and to take courage again from this man from Arimathea. I think just to understand a couple of simple truths. Number one is faith will demand us at some point to take a stand. If you're a person of faith, if you have faith at some point or another, you're going to have to make a stand. You will have to make the proclamation that your faith is bigger than your fear. You will have to, or you will come into a situation where that's what's going to happen. You will have to stand up with Christ. That's just what faith will do. It will demand it. And there will be a time in everybody's lives, probably multiple times in our lives, that faith demands that we take a stand. So Mark, in his gospel account of this story, emphasizes that Joseph exhibited great courage. He says Joseph exhibited great courage before going to Pilate to request the body of Jesus. And we're probably a little too far removed to understand all of the courage that it took to do this. But let's just walk through a couple of options this morning. First, that it took courage for him to stand and ask for the body of Jesus is because under Roman law, the condemned, the cursed person, the one who was sentenced to death, they lost their right to be buried. And so you had two options if you were crucified or if you were executed. Two options, and neither one of them are great. One option was you got left up on the cross and the birds finally took care of you. And so you were meant to be a reminder of this is what happens when you cross the boss, right? This is what happens when you cross Rome. This too could be you on the cross. So that's option one. Option two was this, and probably was more prolific in Jerusalem and Judea and Israel at this time because these were just things they couldn't stand for. It would cause riots a lot of times if Rome just left a Jewish person hanging on the cross. And while Rome didn't mind quashing a few Jewish rebellions here and there, keeping the peace was more ideal, especially during these times of festivals when you had so many more people coming into town. And so what they do is they take them off the cross and they throw them into a giant garbage heap where other unclaimed bodies might go. And that's what would happen under Roman law. So it already takes courage to go to Pilate and say, hey, I would like to go against the law here. Secondly, it takes courage because Pilate is probably already fed up with the Sanhedrin, right? You think about how all of this went. He knows that they've came to him out of jealousy to execute this man. He knows that they've had these trumped up charges. He knows, Pilate knows, all of these things that are going on, that they're just jealous and they're just a fickle group that he's already got problems with. And Joseph is a member of that group of people. The same Sanhedrin that pretty much said to Pilate, hey, if you don't do things the way we want, we're going to go to your manager. We're going to go to Rome and we're going to say, Pilate is no friend of Caesar. And let me tell you, if you're the prefect of Judea, you were probably already no friend of Caesar's. Nobody was asking to get saddled with controlling Judea. But I would like to know a little bit more of that conversation. I wonder if Pilate sort of prodded a little bit. I mean, Joseph had no right to expect that Pilate would be receptive. He had no right to even request the body, and surely he had no right to ask any favors or expect any favors. But third, it also took great courage to do this, because not only was it against the law, and it was like, man, didn't you just, you know, in this moment, Joseph is declaring that he thinks Jesus is worth it. He is aligning himself with the Jesus movement. He's making a stand boldly in the faith of saying, you know what? I watched him from a distance, but I can no longer idly stand by. I have to stand up and let my faith take a stand here. And it takes great boldness and courage to do that. And Joseph of Arimathea did it. So not only will faith demand us to take a stand, but faith will also demand us to pay a price. And this isn't a glamorous side of any of this. Some folks are really talented by preaching about things where it's all about health and wealth. Like if you come to Jesus and all of these things will be taken care of for you. You come to Jesus and your finances will go up. You come to Jesus and you're never going to get sick. And those are all great messages, but they're just wrong, right? They're great to listen to, and I'd like to be a part of some of that, but there's really no some of that to be part of. It's a false narrative. It's a false doctrine. It's not anything that Jesus taught. Jesus taught, if you come to me, you're going to carry a cross just like he did. And that doesn't sound very exciting, but I'll say that the price is always worth it. Well, we get a discount for what we get. I mean, we pay really so little in comparison, but you think of what Joseph here had to pay in the moment. And maybe these are prices that we have to pay as well. Joseph had to pay the price of his personal dignity. Luke 23:52 says that this man went to Pilate and asked for the body of Jesus. And that's really a nice translation that he went and he asked for the body of Jesus. That word asked is better translated to begged, and I wish our translations really said that he begged Pilate. And it's almost as if Pilate made him beg. And granted, think of the whole situation there. If I was Pilate, I might make him beg too, right? Like, it's because of you people that we're here to begin with. And now Pilate's saying, you want me to go against the law, Joseph, so you can have maybe some remorse here? You think you can do this and maybe feel a little bit better about yourself? And so he makes Joseph beg. And I don't know about you, and I haven't had to do it very often, but any time I've had to beg, that's a humbling experience. Maybe a better word is humiliating. That's a humiliating experience. Joseph did not come in and demand. He paid the price with his personal dignity. He set that aside and he humbled himself and he begged for the body of Jesus. The price, and not just his personal dignity, but his social status. He knew that it would change his entire life. It wouldn't be long before word got around that it was him that asked Pilate for the body of Jesus to go bury it. And what would have happened in that moment is word would have gotten back around to the Sanhedrin. And do you think that the Sanhedrin would have been okay with this defector? Somebody who's going against them. I'm going to say that they wouldn't, right? They would have probably, if there was a vote to be had, they probably would have excommunicated Joseph immediately. And that may not seem like a huge deal to us, but he lost every bit of his life that he knew because they wouldn't have just voted him out of the Sanhedrin. They would have stopped him from having any kind of religious influence. This whole man's life, and here now, he's willing to put it all on the line and lose all of it. His friends are going to reject him. His business associates are going to reject him. Lots of people in his family are going to reject him. He's losing it all for this decision. And he says, you know what? That's a price that I'm willing to pay. I mean, we could use a lot more Joseph of Arimathea's today. But really, that's not the only price. He also paid the price of his personal finances. Most believe that the tomb that Jesus was buried in was meant to be Joseph's, that it was a brand new tomb. So presumably, Joseph had commission to have it dug or cut out of the stone for he and his family. And I don't know the cost of digging a tomb. I do know what funeral services cost today. And that can be a small fortune to put on people. And so I know this probably isn't a cheap endeavor either. Joseph is not going to just give some pauper's grave. This is some grave on the outside of a field. He probably could have done that. He probably could have purchased a little plot for next to nothing. But he gives this man his own grave. And you have to remember, Joseph is on the other side of this like we are. He's not expecting his grave to be empty in another 3 days, right? He's expecting to give this grave to Jesus for all of time. He says, I can dig another. I can do something else. He gives his best to Jesus. And I think, how many times do we give Jesus our leftovers? You know, like, we're willing to pay a price, but the price is, you know, it's more of a percentage, right? It's a small amount. When we think it through and we say, well, here, I'll illustrate it. You know, we offer remember back in the olden days when we passed the plate around, and maybe you didn't have very much to put in it, and you know everybody's looking at you, and they're judging how much you're going to put in the plate. Now, they're not, right? But that's what you're thinking in your head. And so you fold up whatever you got as best you can that you think you can get by with giving, and you put it in the plate. And that's a tough way at looking at giving, isn't it? What we think we can get by with doing. Sometimes it's like asking for a discount rate on the heavenly kingdom. Like, hey, is there a sale going on, Jesus? Can I get one of those, buy one, get one free, or 50% off? Can I get that included into my salvation? And as weird as that sounds to say out loud, a lot of us have gone down that road of thinking. Because we're willing to pay a price, but only a price that we want to pay. Not the price that might be asked of us. Not the price that says, will you die to yourself? You might lose everything. Faith is going to demand that you pay a price, and the price isn't going to be always something that you get to choose. So how did Pilate answer this request? Mark 15 says that Pilate was surprised to hear that he should have already died. And so he summoned the centurion and asked him whether he was dead. And so Pilate told Joseph he could have the body. And what that means is now Joseph has to go to the cross. He has to somehow get that cross back down, get the hands and feet of Jesus off of those nails, off of the cross. That would be a terrible job, a difficult job for one person, which leads, I think, to the third thing that I want us to know is faith doesn't demand that we will stand alone. Now, there may be situations and times whenever it feels like you might be standing alone, but faith doesn't demand that you stand alone. You'll always have Jesus with you when you take a stand for Jesus. But in this story, I love that in this story that we're given here, we actually find out that another guy shows up to help Joseph. And his name is Nicodemus. And we've all been to church a time or two. We know Nicodemus's name before. He showed up to Jesus in the night and had a conversation with Jesus in John chapter 3. Nicodemus is also a member of the Sanhedrin. He's also a secret disciple who is deciding to take a stand because he sees his brother taking a stand. Because one of his fellow Sanhedrin is taking a stand, Nicodemus says, you know what? I'll stand with you. And that's what it takes. Sometimes that all it takes is one person saying, I'm going to make my stand here. This shouldn't be happening. This is wrong. And if no one else is going to take a stand, I'm going to. And you know what happens is a lot of times is somebody else says, I'm going to too. Well, once they see that somebody else has courage, they're like, I can take that stand too. That person shouldn't have to stand alone. And I agree. No one should ever have to stand alone. Faith does not demand that you're going to have to stand alone. Again, sometimes it might feel like it. These two secret disciples, while all the other disciples that we know, all of the stories from the Gospels about these two guys, they don't run. They show up. They show up at a pivotal moment, because if they wouldn't have shown up, guess what? There's no burial. There's no tomb for Jesus to break open. All of the other disciples who knew the stories, who seen the miracles, they're gone. These two guys show up and they prepare the body of Jesus for burial. John 19:39 says, Nicodemus came bringing a mixture of myrrh and aloes, about 75 pounds in weight. So they took the body of Jesus and bound it in linen cloths and with spices, as the burial custom of the Jews. They didn't just take the body of Jesus and wrap him up in some old rags and toss him in this place, hoping nobody noticed what they had just done. No, they went and they brought 75 pounds of perfumed ointment. That's like a whole Bath and Body Works store, right? That's a lot. I don't know how much that is. 75 pounds, I guess I do know how much it is. That's a lot of ointment. But sort of the fascinating thing that I don't know that many of us realize is that amount of ointment is the amount of ointment reserved for royalty. It for sure wasn't necessary. I mean, it was necessary to a point. The perfumed ointment was good, and it was needed for somebody being buried in the tomb, but 75 pounds is overkill. That's what royalty gets. So in other words, these men are declaring, they're not just declaring, hey, we think that this was a good and righteous man who got a raw deal. He was innocent and shouldn't have died on the cross. No, they're trying to, some ways, make amends by making sure that he's buried. They are declaring that this man, who we have secretly been following for a while, they are declaring now for everyone to know this truly is the king. And again, the crazy part is this is a dead man, right? They're doing it for a dead guy, a guy that will never be able to repay them. And again, they haven't figured out the rest of the story. Nobody's figured out what's going to happen. Everybody is surprised when Sunday rolls around, right? And this tomb is empty. We have the benefit of living on the other side and know what happens in 3 days. We know what's going on, but they don't. And so they're doing this for a dead guy that has no chance of repaying them, and they're going to lose everything that they have by doing it. Their status is gone. They're probably going to have to run and be on the flee from the Jewish establishment, at least for a time, and they're willing to do that. They're sort of saying, Jesus was right. The centurion was right. Surely this was the Son of God. And we're going to bury this guy like a king. And that's what they do. The burial of Jesus shows boldness of these once secret disciples, or secret disciple and his friend Nicodemus. The story of Joseph, I think, does two things for me. One, it encourages me, and two, it convicts me. And I think it encouraged me probably somewhat because of the conviction. It has within me, the conviction is I know that there are times in my life, and I would like to say it was years ago, but it was probably like Tuesday of this past week where I had a situation where I could have taken a stand for Jesus. And it may have not have been anything huge. It may have been, you know, just something trivial. But I didn't do anything like that. You know, you sort of have the opportunity to wash someone's feet, contextualized in our society, and I just sort of ignored that and let it go by. And I knew, and a lot of times we all know in our heart what you should do, but I didn't. And maybe I just kept driving on by, and I'm the secret disciple in that situation. That person had no clue that I followed Christ, and I sure didn't act like I did. No one else knows that I'm following Christ, because in that situation, whenever I could have shined a light on Jesus, I didn't take that opportunity. And that happens more often to me than I would like to admit. And I'll take a wild guess that it probably happens to you too. And I think that's convicting. And I don't like that. but I do find encouragement that I don't know how many times Joseph of Arimathea had these moments where he was like, I should speak up now. I should take a stand for Jesus now. And then his fear holds him back. Now, I'm wondering if there was ever, when he was with the Sanhedrin and they were plotting to kill Jesus, and he's like, should I say something now? I don't know if now's the right time, but when will be the right time? The opportunity finally presents itself one last time, and he finally says, no more. He finally doesn't allow fear to have a hold on him anymore. I'm not going to bow sort of to that God of fear. And so he takes a stand and he proclaims that not only who Jesus is, that he's his Lord, but that Jesus is my Lord. And I don't care who knows. In fact, Joseph sort of says, I hope everybody knows. And so what convicts me is also what gives me courage for the next time it comes. Maybe the next time it comes, I'll have a little bit more courage. Hopefully a whole lot more courage. So maybe you're convicted and encouraged the same way that I am. And I know we sort of always come to this invitation, and it's an opportunity for us to be open and honest with each other about our struggles and our fears and different things that are going on. But here's the thing. I'll put us all out on blast. From conversations that I have out in that lobby many times, I hear, Mike, I should have came forward this morning. I always say, me too, right? But why don't we? Or why didn't you? See, I had so many things on my heart that I could say, but we don't. And sometimes it just boils down to fear. Fear dictating your decision. And I'm certainly not saying that everybody needs to come forward this morning, but I won't stand up in here and say that nobody doesn't either. You may have some things that you do need to talk about, that you need to put before the whole congregation, that you need to say, look, no more hiding. I'm opening up here before the Lord, and I'm taking my stand. I don't care the price that it takes, and I know that I won't be standing alone. So this morning, I would say stop letting fear dictate your life and let faith change everything. And if that sounds like something that you can do, then I think you have the Holy Spirit's courage starting to tap you on your heart, tap you on your shoulder. It's starting to say, take hold and let that Spirit really run through your life and watch what happens. And that's what I'll encourage us all this week to do, to not let fear dictate our decisions about faith. And so this morning, you might be here and you've never put Christ on in baptism. Maybe you've came to the point where you're ready to make that decision to put Christ on in baptism and leave your old walk behind and to be raised up to walk in the newness of life. Maybe you are a Christian and have needs that need to be addressed by the congregation, as we just talked about. Now would be an opportune time for any need that you have, as together we stand and we sing.